decision?
Well, it's eveangler.com. And is the Eve for Leader NDP or Eve for NDP Leaders site still up?
Yeah, oh, for sure. And it's the same platform that Bianca's running on. And it's a big team. It's not just, just the two of us. There's, dozens and dozens who are working day and night on this campaign. And then there's hundreds and hundreds more who've assisted in different ways.
Yeah, I'm looking at her site now. Bianca Magyanyi enters NDP leadership race. That's eveforndpleader.ca. Go there to find out more and to help. Thanks, as always, Eve, for coming on. I want everyone else to stay tuned. I'm going to take a break, but I'm going to be back with Ricardo Vosch, all things being equal, because he's in Caracas. And I talked to Ricardo last month about, hey, how are things going in Caracas? And things are going a lot worse now than the last time we spoke. And hopefully we can, electricity is spotty and everything else. And he, of course, is pretty busy, but he's a journalist down there based in Caracas. That's after the break. Thanks again, AE, for coming on. And good luck with the leadership bid and the court case. You're January 26th, is it?
January 23rd.
23rd in court. We'll watch for that. Maybe we can speak afterwards. And if you're not in the, sent off to Devil's Island or whatever.
Thanks.
Okay, till the next time. When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
Ceasefire, except there never was. It's the occupation army doing as it does. Whatever them in the nest set, tell them to another bunker bust. Then bomb dropped on you. If they handed over the bodies of the hostages killed after 2 years of bombing as the Zionists willed, the Palestinians would maybe be allowed to eat. But until they find that body beneath the street. They talk about some kind of phase, obsessed by some kind of Israel craze, pretending aid agencies should withhold food from the resistance if that's what they're told. On the media, they don't say collective punishment. They blame occupied people for where their children went. The Israelis say they will carefully examine who was killed by bombing, who was killed by famine. They have starved so many, and then by exposure, so many more buried by bulldozers, buried by bombs and by the West, along with any notion of decency it could ever attest. They killed 500 aid workers already. Now they want to keep the number steady of aid workers they assassinate with bombs shipped from the United States.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, even as the world watches Venezuela, getting an accurate picture of what's happened, what is happening, and how Venezuelans think and feel about it through the lens of an increasingly propagandized media is difficult, if not impossible. Ricardo Vosch is a journalist and political analyst. He's a contributor to the communication collectives Tattoo TV and Utopics, and his articles appear regularly at Venezuela Analysis. His latest piece there is Venezuela, Brazil to send medical aid following U.S. bombing. Welcome back to the program, Ricardo.
Hi, it's great to be back. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, it's my great honor, of course, to have you, Ricardo, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I know that you've been writing like a one-armed paper hanger down there, as can be expected, and doing tons of interviews. So I really appreciate you coming on. Ricardo, what's going on now? Right, tell us first where you are and what's happening.
Yes, I'm in the center of Caracas, and I was actually awake when the bombing began. This was 2 a.m. on Saturday, on the early hours of Saturday. And I mean, I had never experienced anything like this, and I wasn't particularly close to any of the sites that turned out to be bombed. So I mean, as you can tell, there's an entire country still trying to process what happened, trying to come to grips with the trauma, with, you know, life returning to normal. But, you know, the one element that maybe we can discuss in more detail is that there have been constant mobilizations from government supporters, from organized movements. Right now, as we speak, the people from the communes across the country have gathered in Caracas to demonstrate, of course, to reject and denounce this savage U.S. bombing that took place, and also demand the release and return of kidnapped Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro.
Yeah, well, in your latest article, now Brazil sends medical aid following U.S. bombings. What about the injured and killed on the ground there? And you have to understand, Ricardo, up here in Canada, the kind of news we're getting is really terrible. What news we do get? Can you confirm how many people were killed and what happened on that terrible night?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I can't really give a definitive answer because, and I think this is a bit unacceptable, the Venezuelan authorities have yet to publish a detailed list of all the people who killed. I mean, there are unconfirmed unofficial reports that it was 80. We don't know if they were all, I mean, how many of those were military, how many of those were civilians. But as far as we know, the U.S. operation began first with an electromagnetic attack to really disable all sorts of command and control, radar, communication services, and then bombings against important military sites in Caracas and surrounding areas. I mean, first, chief among them, Fuerte Tiuna, that's the main military installation here, about, you know, 5 kilometers from where I am. But there were also other items, other locations bombed. One of them was the port in La Guaira, so close to the shore. That's where these warehouses with medical equipment were destroyed. Luckily, it seems that there have been immediate medicine shipments, so that, you know, dialysis patients cannot really go without treatment, so it looks like they're not going to be affected. And just this morning, we had confirmation, there were rumors before, that Venezuela's IVIC, that's the Venezuelan Center for Scientific Research, which is on the outskirts of the capital, was also bombed. And a few research centers were destroyed. We still don't know. I suspect that there were some military sites nearby and that this was a kind of a lack of precision, but it might also be that the U.S. just directly targeted civilian infrastructure as well.
And what about military resistance? It was suggested that there wasn't any and that there was some sort of conspiracy or even that that President Maduro had inked some kind of deal to leave office that he was keeping secret or something like that. The fact that there were many deaths among the military during this suggests that puts that to the lie.
Yeah, I'll start with the last one. The idea that Maduro might have wanted this, I think that's very far-fetched. I mean, it was reported, of course, we never know if this is true or not, that he had been offered options of exile. So I think that would have been far preferable than to be snatched and kidnapped by a special operations team. As for the idea of a conspiracy, I also think that, I mean, it's of course theoretically possible, but I don't think the elements we see on the ground sustain that. I think ultimately, and as painful as it is to admit, this was a case of just absolute U.S. military and technological supremacy in disabling Venezuelan defenses and being able to penetrate with helicopters and conduct this special operation. I think there also needs to be a realistic assessment of the Venezuelan military's lack of ability and lack of readiness. You know, there were reports that, you know, half of the military personnel were on holiday vacation, so they weren't even at their posts. It looks like they weren't expecting this at all, which also says a lot. But I mean, ultimately, there had to be some kind of treason from Maduro's inner circle, from his security circle, because it was known that he was switching where he slept every day. So for the U.S. to have that information in real time, otherwise they would not have conducted this operation, there had to be some infiltration. There were reports that the CIA had managed to do so. And as you were saying, there was resistance, at least at this final moment when the special operations team were attempting to capture Maduro. And the one thing that we have confirmed are 32 Cuban nationals that died in combat. They were very heavily involved in Maduro's security, and they put up as much resistance as they could against, you know, a superiorly armed enemy. So that's more or less what we know so far. We're still waiting for more official statements and information from at least the defense ministry.
And what about, Ricardo, the condition of the president and first lady right now? I've been seeing all kinds of different reports and photographs. We're not sure, you know, we can't be sure what is real and what is doctored. Do you have any information about what injuries they may have sustained during this kidnapping attack and afterwards?
So what we know, I mean, at least Trump said it, so we never know how much of it is true, is that Maduro and First Lady Cecilia Flores tried, once the special forces were in, tried to get to a bunker that they had inside the residence, and they were violently overrun, something like this. So they were tackled. From the images, it was clear that Maduro was limping from one leg, and Flores's attorney said that there were suspicions of broken ribs, I believe. So that's something very painful. And I know that solidarity movements in the United States have been demonstrating outside the prison, and they're going to put pressure to ensure that they get the necessary medical attention.
Wait, how is the video of the treatment of the president being displayed, it seems, in a police van through the streets of New York City, shackled and treated as a criminal, even worse? What's the reaction to that?
I mean, obviously, it's very tough and it's very painful to see that. But at the same time, I think people have been uplifted by seeing Maduro kind of stand firm, you know, not giving them the satisfaction of seeing him defeated or humiliated. So he has stood firm, even sounding jovial, you know, wishing everyone a happy new year and stuff like this. So I think that has had paradoxically perhaps a message of encouraging people here to go out on the streets and demonstrate and demand his return.
It doesn't seem, well, there is the demand for his return, and that seems pretty unlikely in any event. It won't be like Hugo Chavez in 2002. But in the meantime, the serving president now, Rodriguez, this BBC is reporting, and I beg everyone take what BBC says with a huge grain of salt, but they are reporting that she has fired Javier Marcano Tabata, the head of the Presidential Honor Guard. Is that true?
Yes. So she replaced the head of the Presidential Honor Guard. I'm guessing that now that she's acting president, she will want someone that she trusts more directly. But again, I mean, there are questions to be answered. What was the contingency plan from the Presidential Guard, and why? Where did it fail? Where was it infiltrated? We're not going to get all these answers in public, but I'm sure, I hope that those inquiries are ongoing.
Have there been any charges filed or any arrests made within the military that you're aware of?
I mean, there are always rumors, but it's at this stage unconfirmed. Maduro's son, who's also a National Assembly legislator, said something like, in due time, we'll know who the traitors were. So I expect that there should be a lot of questions being asked inside the military and security circles to try and understand why this happened, you know, even with the U.S., superiority and supremacy. Where did the contingency and defense plans fail to at least ensure that it doesn't happen again, and that if there are people responsible, they be held accountable?
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ricardo Vosch. Ricardo is a journalist and political analyst. He is in Caracas. He's a contributor to the communication collectives there, Tattoo TV and Utopics. His articles appear regularly at Venezuela Analysis, among other places. His latest at Venezuela Analysis is Venezuela, Brazil to send medical aid following U.S. bombing. Ricardo, I told you the news we get up here is pretty bad. When I talk to my workmates, they say, yeah, well, Maduro is not really very popular, that he wasn't legitimately elected. This is what the prime minister of our country, Canada, is saying in in their lack of condemnation of what the Americans have done. The position up here is, well, he wasn't legitimate anyway, so it's okay, I guess, is the position coming from our government, and it seems across the Western world. Can you clarify? You mentioned that there's people out in the streets in their tens of thousands. How popular is Maduro, this kidnapping notwithstanding? And is there any credence to the claims that that the 2019 election was fixed and subsequent elections?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing before getting into an answer is actually rejecting the premise, right? Here, if we're talking about international law, it has to be universal. It's not that, you know, if certain boxes are ticked, then it's okay for one country to go into another and abduct a sitting president, right? I mean, it's important to not allow that premise to stand, so that later we are discussing who deserves to be kidnapped and who doesn't. I mean, immunity and you know, in the eyes of the law, should not be facing this kind of scrutiny, right? Otherwise, can you imagine the reaction if Russia levied charges against I don't know, the president of Romania, and then went in and grabbed him? I mean, it would be absolutely unthinkable in Western circles to tolerate something like this. But to your point, I mean, they talk about the 2018 election, and I mean, it's absolutely false that there was any kind of irregularities or fraud at the time. But it's important to understand that Venezuela has been under economic terrorism, you know, these unilateral sanctions from the U.S. at least since 2017, even though, you know, pressure began before. And as you can expect, given the level of damage that it has imposed for living standards, it has eroded the support of the Bolivarian project and the Venezuelan government as a consequence. But that being said, and perhaps contrary to many predictions, there still remains a very, very significant core of support that is very likely to mobilize in situations like this. And that's exactly what we're seeing now in the streets of Caracas. There have been mobilizations. I mean, on Saturday, immediately, I think there's kind of an instinct whenever something happens to gather close to Miraflores Palace. I think it goes back to this 2002 coup that you were mentioning. And people at the time were still a bit unaware of what was going on. The Venezuelan authorities took a while to react. But then on Sunday, there was a big march. Same on Monday. Yesterday, there was a demonstration from women's organizations. Today, there's a demonstration from popular and communal organizations. And I think that's going to continue, at least for a bit, you know, to, you know, not allow despair to take hold, and also to not allow this situation to be normalized, you know, when you have a sitting president kidnapped by a foreign power.
Well, again, in the press up here, we have headlines like the U.S. will control Venezuela oil sales, quote, indefinitely. This is coming from the American administration. There's also people up here on the left saying, oh, well, this is a failed coup attempt because Rodriguez is the president. Vice President Rodriguez has taken over. There's been a transition and everything is going on as before, albeit without President Maduro and these people that have been killed and the damages inflicted. Where on these two poles are we? Where does reality lie?
I mean, I think it will inevitably lie in the middle. I mean, this has been a very traumatic episode to process. I mean, for us in the country, for the left around the world and all of that. So, I mean, we will have to rethink our positions as the dust settles. I mean, of course, here the institutions, to their credit, were quick to react and, you know, not allow any kind of chaos to emerge. And so what has happened is what is predicted in the Constitution. Of course, the Constitution does not have a provision for what to do when a foreign power kidnaps your president, but it does have one clause about the temporary absence, which is what the Supreme Court has classified. And in that case, the vice president takes over in a temporary and interim basis. And that's what we're seeing with Delcy Rodriguez for a 90-day period. And then the National Assembly can renew it for other periods, and I would very much bet that that's what happens, because they want to keep the pressure as much as possible and demand Maduro's return. And now about the oil, I mean, we saw the switch being flipped. I mean, first Trump was talking about migrants and all these absurd claims that Venezuela dumped its prison population inside the U.S. and also from mental institutions. And nobody actually questions him on that. And then at some point, he switched it to drugs. They're sending in a lot of drugs, even though not even the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency believes that. And then at some point, he just completely switched and it's all about the oil. And that's what we're seeing. So kind of at gunpoint, the U.S. is demanding almost exclusive access to Venezuelan oil exports. And we'll have to see how it works in practice, because you cannot just take these statements from U.S. officials at face value. What they're saying is that the U.S. in some form is going to control the Venezuelan oil production. They are going to sell it and then somehow get the proceeds back to Venezuela. I would very much doubt that that's the final arrangement. But they've also talked about other stuff, you know, some flexibilization of sanctions that would allow diluents to come into Venezuela in order to process crude, as well as import spare parts, and then eventually create conditions for the return of U.S. Companies. So it's going to be very difficult. It's a tricky balance that the new government in Venezuela has to strike in terms of using whatever conditions they have to continue recovering oil production, but at the same time, doing what they can to defend sovereignty against the threat that, you know, there might be a bombing if the U.S. demands are not met.
Yeah, yeah. Trump, the American president, said that they've done a deal for 50 million barrels of oil with the United States. Secretary Marco Rubio says his aim was, quote, to make sure that the oil sales benefits the Venezuelan people, not corruption, not the regime. So we have a lot of leverage to move on the stabilization front, as they would have it. But the Democratic Senator Chris Murphy says he calls this plan insane. He says, quote, they are talking about stealing the Venezuelan oil at gunpoint for a period of time undefined as leverage to micromanage that country. He says this, the scope of this is insanity. What, Ricardo, about the Chinese and Russian clients of Venezuela? It seems the economy was actually looking up somewhat because of these deals, especially with China. What about this aspect of what's happening? Are the blockades of the oil tankers, blowing up of small boats that we've seen the last time you and I talked, it was on that topic, and trade with China, is this going to continue? Is the current government promising that deals signed will be honored?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good point. When leverage has been Rubio's favorite word this week, and just this morning, the U.S. seized another two tankers for the, you know, quote-unquote crime of being involved in the Venezuelan oil industry. So I think what the U.S. wants is for all the Venezuelan crude to go into U.S. refineries. And actually, U.S. refineries have the ability to absorb that. So it will be kind of a double victory. On one hand, cheaper energy supplies for the U.S., and on the other, depriving China of these crude shipments. They are about 4 to 5% of Chinese imports, so it's not going to be a huge blow. I think the Chinese refineries will find a way to adjust. And what we have to understand is that because of sanctions, Venezuela wasn't really doing major deals with the Chinese state or even private companies. Instead, it was doing spot deals, so kind of one shipment at a time with a given intermediary that then goes to the high seas and transfers the crude to another ship and then goes to Malaysia and relabels, and then it eventually gets to China. So in that sense, it's not so complicated to divert these shipments to the United States. But Trump himself said, you know, when he was asked on right after the bombings on Saturday, he had a press conference, and someone asked him, you know, what about the Russian and Chinese who are purchasing the oil? And he said something like, you know, they can buy it from us now. So it's just a blatant neo-colonial effort to, you know, as Murphy's saying, control the Venezuelan oil industry at gunpoint.
Well, already the news up here in Canada, there's worry at the stock markets that the Canadian tar sands are, the price of oil from them is tumbling. These are the competitors, roughly the same kind of oil that comes from Venezuela. What's the the impression from Venezuela about countries like Canada and the Western countries and their knee-jerk support for the American position and its actions, criminal though they may be?
Yeah, it's been, of course, firing in from all directions in terms of supporting this. I mean, there seemed to be at least a little period of indecision, given just how blatant this was. But I mean, in time, everyone has more or less fallen in line. And I have to say, I mean, I think the international response has been, it has been rhetorically good, but ultimately ineffective. I mean, we saw the UN Security Council meet on Monday, and there were lots of condemnation and statements saying that red lines had been crossed and so on. But in the end, there wasn't even a resolution, I don't know, demanding Maduro's release, even, you know, just forcing the U.S. to use its veto power. But we didn't even get to that point. So it's clear that the U.S. feels that there is no real challenge for them to do whatever they can, whatever they want here in this hemisphere. And now, you know, just after they completed this bombings in Venezuela, Trump said, Mexico, Colombia and Cuba might be next. So if there was ever a time to produce regional unity, I would say now is the time.
Well, and Greenland and Canada too.
Yes,
to
no,
be sure.
Nobody's safe.
Well, in your article again, and it's your latest article at Venezuela Analysis, Venezuela, Brazil to send medical aid following U.S. bombing. What about those countries that have offered support, rhetorical and otherwise, like Brazil? Lula, the president, he disallowed Venezuela join the BRICS coalition of nations. Has there been any indication that Brazil would change its mind on that? Has BRICS and other BRIC countries gotten together to issue resolutions of their own regarding what's going on in Venezuela?
No, unfortunately not. I think Brazil might have some sense of guilt because if Venezuela had become a member of BRICS, maybe there would have been a bit more diplomatic cover to avoid something like this. But even within the BRICS, I mean, the coalition has become so expanded so quickly that you have countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates who have said nothing about this. I mean, they're not bothered at all. So, and they are a close U.S. ally. So it's very unlikely that there will be any kind of response, unfortunately, that there will be some kind of response from the BRICS. And you also saw nothing at the Security Council. Maybe there will be some resolution at the U.N. General Assembly. But it does show that, you know, the international rules-based order is probably expiring in real time, you know, whatever, however real it ever was. And there's a need to create new sorts of international relations that can actually have a tangible effect in opposing these kinds of barbarism.
Well, Ricardo, finally, what are you working on now? What should we outside of Venezuela be paying attention to?
Yeah, I mean, right now we have to see how these oil allegations play out. I'm actually going to write about this later today. And then hopefully within a week or so, I hope to have time to write about the media coverage about this, you know, how they are referring to Maduro being ousted or being captured as if he was, you know, as you were saying before, like a common criminal. You know, the role of the media in allowing this should not be underestimated. And at least that's my trench and where I hope to fight back. So I encourage people to visit Venezuela Analysis. We're still running a fundraiser, even though now it's faded into the background. We have bigger things to worry about. But if they can, support our independent journalism.
That's VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And yeah, I disagree, Ricardo, that it's very important. It's of the utmost importance that there be alternative media to what we're hearing. And as I said, when I talk to my workmates, I'm a working man and we're just regular people for the most part. Their take on what's going on in Venezuela coming from the media that we have available is entirely opposite to my own formed opinion from talking to people like you. It is nine, you know, six equals nine. So, I mean, it can't be underestimated. Support VenezuelaAnalysis.com and other alternative outlets. Thank you so much, Ricardo, for making the time to come on this show again. And I wish you and everybody in Venezuela all the best in this trying time.
Yeah, thanks again for the invitation. I look forward to coming back and discussing hopefully in a better situation. Thanks again.
Yeah, you bet. And thanks to Eve Engler. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time.
Starved so many, and then by exposure, so many more buried by bulldozers, buried by bombs and by the West, along with any notion of decency it could ever attest. They killed 500 aid workers already. Now they want to keep the number steady of aid workers they assassinate with bombs shipped from the United States.